All right. Good afternoon, everybody. This is the afternoon session of the Portland City Council. We have one item up. Carla, could you start by calling the roll, please?
Ritz?
Here.
Fish?
Here.
Heltzman?
Here.
Udaly?
Here.
Wheeler?
Here. Could you please read the first and last item?
Agenda item 187, appeal of the Citizen Review Committee against Portland Police Bureau's finding regarding independent police review, internal affairs, case number 2015-C-0104, appeal number 2015-X0002.
Very good. Thank you. And I have a rather lengthy script that I'm required to read as part of these proceedings, so bear with me. The council will now take up Agenda Item 187, scheduled for a time certain to consider the appeal from the Citizen Review Committee of the Portland Police Bureau's finding regarding independent police review internal affairs case number 2015-C-104, appeal number 2015-X-0002. This matter is being heard by counsel pursuant to Portland City Code Section 3.21.160. This is not a public hearing with public testimony. Rather, counsel is reviewing a decision of the Portland Police Bureau, which the CRC has appealed to the council. The council must decide if the PPB decision is or is not supported by the evidence in the record. The council will not hear new evidence, and it will not take public testimony. I want to note that members of the council have received emails from the complainant in this matter. These emails are not part of the record and will not be considered, although the complainant will have an opportunity to address us here today. The hearing is going to be conducted as follows. First, IPR will present the case and the procedural history. Second, CRC will outline the basis for its appeal and its areas of disagreement with the PPB decision. Three, the complainant or a representative will have 10 minutes to present. Fourth, the Portland Police Bureau will have 10 minutes to present. Five, the involved officer or a representative may elect to make a voluntary statement of up to 10 minutes. Counsel will then have an opportunity to ask questions of any of the presenters. Counsel is asked to hold all questions until the presentations of the IPR, the CRC, the complainant, the police bureau, and the involved officer are all concluded. Council will then have a discussion. Council may elect to move into executive session for its discussion. Executive session would be authorized under one or both of the following statutes: ORS 192.6602B or ORS 192.6602F. If the council decides to hold its discussion in executive session, an announcement of the executive session and the grounds for going into executive session will be made before the council goes into executive session. Eight, following council discussion, I will entertain a motion and second and will vote on whether the police bureau finding is supported by the evidence. The police bureau finding was, quote, exonerated with a debriefing, unquote. Portland City Code Section 3.21.020S defines supported by the evidence as, quote, a finding regarding a complaint is supported by the evidence when a reasonable person could make the finding in light of the evidence, whether or not the reviewing body agrees with the finding, unquote. Nine, if counsel determines that the police bureau finding of exonerated with debriefing is supported by the evidence, the complaint will be closed. 10. If counsel determines that the police bureau finding of exonerated with a debriefing is not supported by the evidence, counsel will need to decide on the appropriate finding in this case. Counsel needs to select from the following alternative findings. Unfounded. The allegation, meaning the allegation was false or devoid of fact, or there was not a credible basis for a possible violation of policy procedure. Exonerated. That means the act occurred but was lawful and within policy. Not sustained. That means the evidence was insufficient to prove a violation of policy or procedure. Sustained, meaning the evidence was sufficient to prove a violation of policy or procedure. A finding of exonerated, not sustained, or sustained is based on a preponderance of the evidence. That is, the facts and circumstances indicated it is more likely than not that the violation of policy or procedure either occurred or did not occur. Debriefings may be recommended for unfounded, exonerated, or not sustained findings when it's believed the subject employee would benefit from a discussion and critique of the incident. Pursuant to Portland City Code Section 3.21.160C, no new evidence may be introduced at this hearing. 12, to help protect the identity and the privacy of the individuals involved, during public hearing, counsel will not refer to them by name, but will refer to them generically as complainant, witness A, Sergeant A, Officer B, and so forth. 13, since Portland City Code provides that no new evidence may be introduced at the hearing, and because this matter involves counsel's review of a community member complaint that potentially could result in discipline, public comment or testimony regarding this matter will not be solicited or received. So with that, we will now begin. We'll start with IPR, who will present the case and the procedural history. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mayor Wheeler and Commissioners. I'm Anika Bentalber, Assistant Director of the Independent Police Review. I will provide a brief incident overview and summary of the procedural history of this case before you on appeal today. On September 17, 2014, Sergeant A observed a woman calling for help. The woman told Sergeant A that appellant had just circled her car and was punching her windows. Sergeant A contacted appellant. Police reports indicated appellant was verbally aggressive and kept putting his hands in his pockets, though appellant indicated later when interviewed that he had his hands up and attempted to de-escalate the encounter. The police reports further indicated Sergeant A turned appellant around and pushed him up against a wall to try to handcuff him, but was unable to do so due to appellant's level of resistance. Officer B arrived, warned appellant that he would be tased if he did not comply with orders, and then deployed his taser in drive-stun mode on appellant. Appellant went to the ground but continued to resist. Officer B then deployed a second drive-stun taser in an attempt to handcuff. Officer B then used his taser in probe mode, and the officers were able to handcuff appellant. Appellant complains that the officers used excessive force and excessive number of taser cycle rounds from the electronic control weapon. Now for the summary of the procedural history. I was the assigned IPR director to review this case. This complaint did not originate through the IPR intake process. It was referred by the city's risk management office after they received a federal complaint filed by appellant on March 17, 2015. The federal complaint stemmed from an encounter with Portland Police Bureau officers on the date of September 17, 2014. Portland Police Bureau's Internal Affairs initiated an administrative investigation on May 5, 2015 as part of the routine tort review process. IPR requested that Internal Affairs open an investigation due to the nature of the allegation of excessive force. After the investigation was completed and findings were made, disposition of the investigation was sent to appellant. Appellant was provided with the option to appeal to the Citizens Review Committee, CRC, if dissatisfied with the results of the findings. IPR received appellant's appeal of the Bureau's findings, and the CRC held the case file review of the case on October 7, 2015. At the conclusion of the case file review, the investigation was sent back to Internal Affairs for additional investigation. After additional investigation was obtained, the first appeal hearing was scheduled for April 20, 2016, but was subsequently canceled because Bureau members were ordered not to appear per order from former Acting Chief Henderson. On May 4th, 2016, the CRC conducted the second appeal hearing in which they voted 8-0 to challenge the first allegation findings from exonerated to exonerated with debriefing. The CRC voted 7-1 to affirm the second allegation finding of exonerated with debriefing. On May 6th, IPR received notification from Internal Affairs that allegation number 2 would be sent back to Internal Affairs for new findings due to the incorrect version of the Police Bureau directive being used in the findings process. The Bureau accepted the CRC recommendation regarding allegation number one. On September 7, 2016, the CRC conducted a third appeal hearing for allegation number two, this time with the correct directive, and they voted 6 in favor with 2 members abstaining to challenge allegation number two from exonerated with debriefing to sustained. On December 7, 2016, the CRC held a conference hearing with Portland Police Bureau Chief Michael Marshman, and the CRC voted 4 in favor, 1 abstain to continue with their original challenge motion of sustained on allegation number two. That all leads us to today, as no agreement could be reached between the CRC and the Police Bureau during the conference hearing. An appeal hearing was set before City Council. At the conclusion of this hearing, the City Council must decide whether a reasonable person could conclude that a finding of exonerated with debriefing is supported by the evidence with regards to allegation Officer B used inappropriate force while taking appellant into custody. That's what I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, CRC will address the basis for its appeal and the areas of disagreement with the PBB decision. Good afternoon.
My name is Kristen Malone. I'm the chair of the Citizen Review Committee. I know most of you are familiar with the committee, but for the new faces on the council and in the community, the CRC is a volunteer body comprised of 11 community members. We have several responsibilities, including hearing appeals concerning allegations that members of the Portland Police Bureau have violated city policy. As we review the conclusions reached by the Bureau's initial decision makers, we have the authority to challenge findings that are not supported by the evidence. When that happens, we have an opportunity to resolve these differences through dialogue with the Bureau. In the rare case that the CRC and the Bureau are unable to agree on the proper finding on an allegation, City Codes provides that you all have the final say. This is so rare that I believe this is only the second such hearing in the past decade. So if this procedure is foreign to you, we're all in the same boat. I prepared a short presentation that I hope will give you the most insight. I would have invited questions, but I just heard that we're saving them till the end, so I'm happy to answer them if you are banking them in your mind. For a quick summary of the facts giving rise to the case, which I'm sure you've had a chance to review in detail in the case file, on September 17, 2014, several PPB members dispatched to a Northwest Portland intersection following a report that a cyclist, the appellant, had struck the window of a motorist while stopped at a traffic light. Sergeant A contacted the appellant first, followed by officers B and D. After the appellant began shouting and emptying his pockets on the ground, the officers took steps to restrain him. The three officers worked together to push the appellant up to a wall and tried to handcuff him, while the appellant struggled against the officers. During this time, Officer B issued a taser warning and discharged his taser 3 times in rapid succession in the appellant's back. After these initial discharges, the appellant fell to the ground. Sergeant A and Officer D were on top of the appellant's upper body, and Officer B worked to stop the movement of the appellant's legs, which at one point knocked Officer B to the ground. While the appellant was on the ground, Officer B placed the taser directly onto the appellant's calf and released a 4th charge of electricity. As the Bureau members continued to work to handcuff the appellant, Officer B fired the taser's probes into the appellant's back, issuing a 5th activation of the taser. Sometime later, Officer B again discharged the taser, this time apparently by accident. The probes were still attached to the appellant, and the taser log registered an activation of up to 1 second. The Bureau investigated several alleged policy violations relating to this encounter, but the only one remaining for consideration today is allegation 2, which charges that Officer B used inappropriate force in taking appellant into custody. The Bureau found that Officer B's uses of the taser in this incident were lawful and within policy. However, it recommended a debriefing to counsel Officer B on the design differences found in the new X2 taser model he was using, which the Bureau believes led to the last accidental activation. The CRC reviewed the record and held a public hearing to determine whether the Bureau's finding was supported by the evidence. In other words, we, like you, evaluated whether a reasonable person reviewing the evidence in the case file could have concluded that Officer B's uses of force were lawful and within policy. The particular policy we evaluated was a December 2013 executive order regarding Directive 1051.00, which provides rules for the use of electronic control weapons, or tasers. At an appeal hearing, the CRC concluded that the evidence did not support the Bureau's finding and voted to challenge. The CRC recommended a finding of sustained and continued to do so after a conference with Chief Marshman. All of the CRC members who voted and did not abstain agreed that Officer B's conduct was not in line with the directive. There were three main areas of disagreement with the Bureau. First, CRC members felt that the first three uses of the taser were not supported by the directive because appellant's conduct did not meet the definition of active aggression. Although Officer B and only Officer B reported a feeling that the appellant might punch Sergeant A, CRC members found that the evidence showed that the appellant was merely resisting the officer's attempts to restrain him. Three officers had the appellant pinned against a wall and had hold of his arms and torso. Therefore, a reasonable person would have determined that there was no, quote, threat or overt act of assault coupled with the present ability to carry out the threat or assault, unquote. Further, some members found that the directive did not permit the fourth and fifth taser deployments, which occurred after the appellant had been brought to the ground and had three Bureau members on top of him. Section 3.2 of the directive states that, quote, members will not use an ECW on a handcuffed or otherwise restrained subject, for example, a subject being held to the ground by multiple officers, unless the subject is actively engaged in behavior that creates a substantial risk of injury to the subject, members, or others, and no other reasonable force options exist. The video in the record showed that the drive stun to appellant's calf occurred while the appellant was on his right side. Officer B had gotten hold of the appellant's left leg and was kneeling on his right leg, while Officer D pressed on appellant's torso and Sergeant A straddled across his shoulders and held his left arm. Seconds later, when Officer B deployed the probes, appellant had been placed prone on his stomach and appeared well controlled, with Officer B straddling both legs with a knee on appellant's buttocks, while Sergeant A was seated straddling the appellant's lower back. Sergeant A was holding the appellant's left arm and Officer D was holding his right arm. CRC members felt that Section 3.2 specifically prohibited the use of the taser in these circumstances because appellant was well restrained. The circumstances in this case directly track the example in the directive of a subject being held to the ground by multiple officers. CRC members disagreed with the Bureau's conclusion that the taser activations were justified because the appellant was kicking his legs immediately after being taken to the ground and trying to roll over. Some felt that these acts did not rise to the level of active aggression. In any event, the video showed that the appellant was manually restrained and no longer kicking at the time of the activation on his calf, and that he was prone and largely immobile when Officer B deployed the probes. Therefore, with respect to the fourth and fifth cycles of the taser, CRC members found that the evidence did not support a finding that the appellant posed a substantial risk of injury to himself or others, or that the Bureau members lacked other reasonable force options. Finally, the CRC took issue with the final taser deployment, which occurred after the officers believed the appellant to be effectively restrained. This activation was recorded in the taser log, but was not reported by Officer B because he was unaware that it took place. The Bureau believes that this accidental activation occurred because the taser's activation button is placed along the side of the weapon in a similar location to where officers are trained to rest or index their fingers on their firearms. The Bureau has noted that the taser Officer B was using was not the Bureau's standard-issued taser, but instead a new model called the X2, which the Bureau was trying out at the time, and which has now been formally adopted. The Bureau has suggested that the officer's instinct to index his finger instead caused him to tap the activation button, sending another charge of electricity down the attached wires. The CRC found this information useful in understanding how this accident occurred. However, Directive 1051.00 is agnostic as to the particular device being used. It applies to electronic control weapons generally, including the one being used on duty by Officer B. The CRC is not aware of any rule that would suspend the general force guidelines when new weapons are being tested in the field and used on civilians. And rightfully so. Community members have a right to expect that officers are properly trained on any weapons used outside of the training facility, and that in all cases, weapons use will be governed by the Bureau's force and ECW directives. The Bureau has also contended that Officer B should be exonerated with respect to the sixth activation because it lasted only a short time or because it may not have had an effect on the appellant. On the second point, the Bureau characterizes the appellant as not remembering that discharge. But in his IA interview conducted nearly 8 months after the incident, the appellant reported feeling more than 3 charges of electricity during the incident, and he was not asked any follow-up questions on the precise timing of those shocks. In any event, there's no language in the directive allowing otherwise impermissible uses of force based on the duration or amount of pain felt by the citizen. Therefore, CRC members found that the 6th discharge was not justified by the directive and that evidence did not exist to support this use of force. In conclusion, while I've outlined a number of explanations that animated the CRC's challenge, counsel has the opportunity to adopt any, all, or none of them in answering the same question using the same standard, which is whether a reasonable person could conclude, based on the evidence, that the force Officer B used when taking the appellant into custody was lawful and within policy. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Next up, the complainant has 10 minutes to present. Or if I understand the rule, the complainant's representative. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
If it pleases the council, a couple things I've heard so forth.
First, we need your name.
Sorry, my name is Matthew Klug. If it pleases the council. To start with, I saw it piqued your interest. I did file the tort on the 13th of March. It was a Friday the 13th, so it's within the 2 years, or within the 6 months, 180 days that it needed to be filed. The date was given wrong prior. Also, there was no dispatch to the officers. So just to be clear that you can go and look at the paperwork, it says self-dispatched, handwritten, on the paperwork. There was no 911 call either. So this has been mischaracterized yet again in the stuff you just received yesterday or the day before. There was no 911 call. The word call was used in the paperwork, but that was supposedly a verbal call with the alleged victim with her arms out the window saying, "Help, help." That's what this is going off of. Okay, just to start it. It took about 3 minutes between when that happened and when I was in handcuffs. 30 seconds of it is the video. Literally 3 minutes. Okay, this has been characterized as this big thing. It's been 890 days since that occurred till today. Okay, the Tort Review Board asked for review on April 28th, 2015. It's now been 667 days since that occurred. And the target is supposed to be 180 days. So just to put this in perspective, I'm talking about a lot of big issues, but really it's down to the policy at 1051 that I provided. They tried to, at a hearing, present one that was prior and an older version. And on the way out of the hearing, when they apparently won that, down to the commander at the time, Bob Day, and some other people, they were high-fiving Daryl Turner on the way out the door. This has just been, you got to kind of look at the way they behaved, guys, okay? This is going on still. They're trying to mischaracterize this still, and I'm wasting my time talking about this. So I'll get to what I need to say here. My name is Matthew Klug, and I'm a resident of Portland. I'm an epileptic. I'm a survivor of traumatic brain injury from a long time ago, and I'm a coma survivor, and I suffer mental illness. I'm not a lawyer, but I'll explain what happened to me to the best of my ability. These things kept coming to decision points, and decisions were made that kept making this compoundedly worse over and over and over again. This has been 890 days, and I'm still shaking about it now. Really, I have a press release from the auditor's office, and I gave copies to the clerk. This is from January 27th, wanting to get to the bottom of how the Portland Police deals with Brady material. I've got an example right here. After I sued the city and the county, It turns out there was no complainant, but they never put that in the discovery packet, Nick. That's a big deal. And it scares the hell out of me. This is a 1963 Supreme Court decision, and no one's paying any attention over here at the courthouse. I'm calling out to the judges. Somebody pay attention. In their name, they tried to arraign me in absentia. One of the judges put her foot down, thank God. Okay? They tried to arraign me on a bunch of felony counts, 7 counts. They left me in jail. They didn't do it by closed circuit. They didn't do it by video feed. They left me in jail. Now, it's a good thing my parents showed up and a family friend who's an attorney, because if I'd had a different judge or didn't have anyone there on my behalf, I might have been arraigned on 7 felony counts at that point in time. I went home 12 hours after I had the charges dismissed. So, you know, I was never read my Miranda rights, and I was put into general population. You know what kind of searches they do before they put you in general population. So I've searched in different ways before I was put in, but I was never read my rights. Okay, they kept me in jail for another 12 hours after the charges were dismissed by the judge. What's going on there, guys? These are, you know, big issues. I'm sorry to just lop this on you, but to cover up for some kind of like little accidental taser thing, they just kept making just really bad decisions, and this just kept piling on and piling on and piling on to the point where I literally was given another set of charges 43 days later. I don't know where their origin came from. I spent $9,000 on a criminal defense attorney to try to keep me out of jail long enough to file this case that I did file on Friday the 13th. And that's just one of the oddities of this case. But the evidence that there was no complainant wasn't in the packet. Okay? So there was discussion of the charges, but there was no ability to find out the origin of the charges. They were just there 43 days. They must have refiled them. I'm not a lawyer. How did this occur? So I know when they no complaint things, they can go refile them later if they want to. But, you know, was there some kind of other something in the decision making, you know, a risk management decision? I'm not sure along the way what contributed to refiling the charges. So, you know, and at some point, I know it's not double jeopardy, but it comes right up to the line. And now they're going to go after me, and they're probably going to try to arraign me or, you know, try me in the court of public opinion. And, wow, you know, so this is their third attempt at it. And I hope you take that with a grain of salt. So, I know you've read this. And here's the 1051 if you need a copy. I got one for you. Here's my lawsuit with the general allegations in it. I'm sure you've all read this. I don't know what I might have left out. But trying to arraign someone in absentia is just crazy in the United States of America. Take that in, you know, just sitting there in jail. I knew I was supposed to go at 8:30. I never came with any medication. The nurse came every 4 hours. They knew I was epileptic and I required medication. Didn't get any medication for 24 hours. You know, had to go take, they took my $17 and had to go, you know, get $20 out of the bank because they give me some debit card instead of my cash back and get a bus ride home. And I have a seizure before I even get in the door, you know. So this stuff is a big deal. You know, they have some kind of agreement with Rite Aid. All they had to do was send someone down there. I know it's the county and this isn't your, but at some point, this is intersectional in that when you hand the people over, you've got to have some faith that they're not going to be mistreated again and again and again. And so the sergeant who pulled me over, Sergeant A, pulled me over. I pulled over a block after I heard a boop, boop, So, you know, I turned left at a light. I had the green left arrow. And it must have been red for him because I heard the thing. I looked back. There were lights. A block later, I pulled over. Where I pulled over, which is the campus of Northwest College of Art or whatever it is. And the old federal building. And I have a post office box across the street that I've had since 2005, you know. I mean, over 10 years I've had a post office box there, you know. So it's not like I'm a stranger to Portland or downtown, or that's where you used to get your tax forms, guys, you know. I mean, this is Portland, right? What's going on? So I'm just out for a bike ride. It's a little heavy-handed. He came out of the car, reaching, unbuckled his holster, and slid back the cover. Now, that should scare them out of anyone. And it did me. I put my hands up in the air, and I said, and the witnesses in the paperwork heard me say verbally, "What did I do? What did I do?" I didn't know what his animus towards me was, so I said, I didn't. Maybe I'm close to the bus station, so I said, "I'm not homeless." I don't know why I said that. I thought that perhaps he'd lighten up. And the officers came right after that in the old gold unmarked car. And I believe those are the enhanced crisis intervention team members. They did not de-escalate. The first thing they said to me was, "Turn around, turn around." I turned around, and the sergeant did not try to cuff me. They all came at me at the same time.
Thank you very much.
The rest is on the video.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
By the way, you're probably wondering, who am I? My name's Eric Terrell, and I'm the appeal process advisor. Basically, assist the appellant in any way possible. So that's why I was sitting with the appellant.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate
it. Welcome.
Thank you both. Next up, the Portland Police Bureau will make its presentation. They also have 10 minutes. Good afternoon. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mayor. Council members, Mike Marshman, Chief of Police.
And I'm Jeff Bell, Captain of Internal Affairs.
So thank you for the opportunity today. I will try very hard to get my presentation completed within 10 minutes. Captain Bell is going to help along. Part of the slides I think you'll be able to view as we go through this are going to be a little bit redundant, as other folks have testified and spoken to them, so I'll just skip through those as we go. So we shall begin. So as stated earlier, the TASER policy in question today is Directive 1051, act of aggression, I believe is what we're talking about today, and that is a threat or overt act of an assault through physical or verbal means, coupled with the present ability to carry out the threat or assault, which reasonably indicates that an assault or injury to any person is imminent. For the next slide, when reasonable under the circumstances, members are authorized to use the ECW or TASER in the following: in response to active aggression, and second, in drive-stun mode, in the event that the probes are insufficient spread or dislodged, in close quarters, like you'll see in the video, to protect a member, create safe distance, or avoid the use of a higher level of force. And to avoid the higher use of force, I think, is appropriate in this instance. Members will not use a TASER on a handcuffed or otherwise restrained subject. And in our policy, we give the example of a subject being held to the ground by multiple officers, unless the subject is, again, actively engaged in behavior that creates a substantial risk of injury to the subject themselves, member, or others, and no other reasonable force is available. So the reasonableness standard, as was said earlier, the CRC may find the outcome of an administrative investigation like this unreasonable if the committee finds that the findings are not supported by the evidence. I think it's important to note here that the RU manager who wrote the finding, their standard is the preponderance of the evidence, or like a greater weight of the evidence. And that standard that the RU manager uses is a little bit different than the CRC's reasonable person standard. So I went to that pretty quick, but I wanted to get to the video for you. And during the presentation, we'll show the video a couple times. So if you're ready, we can we can show you this encounter. And hopefully technology will work. It's a short video. Throughout the presentation, we'll come to it a couple times. One thing to note, and you'll see it in some videos, you'll be able to see it a couple times. The taser, you see that little flash. That's like the taser going off. In the drive stem mode, if it's raised up higher, it registers a cycle. The computer chip in the taser registers that, but doesn't register that it's making contact or if it's effective. So in a drive stem mode, my assertion is if it's up in the air, and you'll see in the successive videos, it's going, but it's not contacting. And then again, not to get too technical, but that new taser, the Bureau has since adopted it. The officer, Officer B, was testing that, which we do with a lot of tools we deploy in the street. When you index your finger, which we train to, there's a button right there, which is how you activate that in drive stun mode. One of my assertions is when you're struggling, like in that video, when he's getting kicked and rolled over, he's by default clenching because you're getting knocked over. I think he's hitting that button, and that's when you can see the flashes going off. Hopefully, as we proceed further, that'll be a little more clear. So the next slide's background to the call. I think we've been over that. From other testimony, Officer B's statement, it's what he observed. Sergeant A was being yelled at. Complainant's hands were moving rapidly. Officer B believed that the complainant was about to engage Sergeant A in physical altercation. That's what led Officer B to move in and start taking some action. The next statement, as I approached, this is all quotes from Officer B. He notated that complainant was intensely focused on Sergeant A, continually yelling at him, thrusting his hands in his pockets, lowering his head. And from Officer B's training experience, he believes this behavior indicates a person is initiating the physical altercation with Sergeant A. And then again, here's clip one, so you get to see this again. This is the initial contact. So Officer B goes on with his statements. He believes Sergeant A was struggling with complainant. Complainant was arching him back and pushing against Sergeant A. He thought he was going to try to punch him. So that's when he gives the taser warning. Officer B believes the complainant was violent and it continued to escalate. Officer B says the taser was initially effective in deterring the aggressive behavior. Complainant drops his knees and begins kicking his feet. And seeing the officer get kicked over, to me, is active aggression. Officer B says he got kicked multiple times by complainant, causes him to fall to the ground, and he believes the complainant's still struggling. So the last video you saw shows that what I believe is to be active aggression by the complainant in the first 5 seconds of the taser. And again, that taser button, it's pushed 3 times for 3 seconds, 1 second, 1 second. I believe not all those were having contact with a complainant, but the officer, rightly so, was holding on to that because you don't want to lose that taser. So, yes, it does register those, but I don't believe all three of those had contact with the complainant. And again, another video for you, sorry, to watch. I'll get to that in a second. I'm just kind of watching the time here for you. The video shows Officer B gets up after being kicked, employs the taser in drive stun mode again for the 3 seconds. Complainant still kicking and struggling. Basically, we're just trying to get the complainant into custody. I have one more video clip for you. and I'll get to the CRC's concerns. Thanks. So the next slide, the taser probe, Officer C, the second bullet point, she would be on the complainant's right side. She believes the complainant's overpowering her, and she can't get control of his arm. And then you watch this next video, you can see the complainant try to do a push-up. It's a little bit hard to see his right arm. She's struggling, just can't get his arm behind him. So he's not in control. Well, I'm running out of time. I'm going to skip towards CRC concerns. CRC concern number one. Officer B's use of taser was unreasonable because his use was not a response to active aggression. I essentially, my assertion is during a video, I believe complainant is in active aggression with punching or attempting to punch Sergeant A, kicking the officer and having the officer fall to the ground. For CRC concern number two, being restrained since he was held down on the ground by officers during a taser application, yes, we were holding him down, but he wasn't restrained. He continued to fight and kick. The sergeant was struggling to get his right arm. In one of the videos, you could almost see him start to do a push-up with the officers on him. And again, Officer C wasn't able to get control of his right arm. And CRC concern number three, they didn't believe the last discharge of the taser was supported by the evidence. After the complainant was handcuffed, he was still struggling, and you have to take control, maintain control of that taser. He's still struggling even though he's handcuffed. Again, my assertion is, though nobody recalls it, I believe that taser application, it's due to trying to control that taser. So for PBB findings, you've read that. I'll just finish up with seconds left. Again, was that when that taser light goes off in the video, it's not necessarily in a contact with a complainant, though it does register in the taser download.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Next up, the involved officer or a representative make a voluntary statement of up to 10 minutes if they choose to do so. Then the council may now ask questions of any of the presenters.
Mayor, how do you want to do this? Do you want to invite the presenters to come back just so we can do it as one panel?
Why don't we do it this way? Why don't we find out what the nature of the questions are, and then we can invite panelists up individually to answer those questions.
I have a number of clarifying questions I'd like to ask the chief.
Chief, can you come on up?
And I have a couple procedural questions about CRC that I think I'd address to the chair afterwards. Chief, thank you for your presentation. And we were given a very thick folder with a lot of information. And my understanding from a prior conversation I had with Mr. Handelman is this is the first time council has had an appeal like this since 2003.
Yes.
So no one, with the exception perhaps of Commissioner Saltzman, has been through this before. So the rest of us are learning on the fly. So I have some basic questions. From the moment the officers had contact with should we call him the complainant at this point? The complainant. How long did it take to get the complainant into custody?
I don't have that specific time frame, but I believe that video that you saw, it's obviously towards the beginning. He wasn't handcuffed at the end of that. I assume he's handcuffed fairly quickly after that. So
this entire 15, encounter lasted
seconds.
How long?
I'm guessing I can pull up the video, maybe 15, 20 seconds. It's fairly brief.
Okay. Is it relevant to your analysis that there were three officers involved?
Very much.
Three police officers that were engaging the complainant?
Yes, sir. Very relevant.
And at what point would the number of officers involved begin to change your the way in which you view restraint or whether a other kind of force was warranted? I guess the point I'm trying to get at is the difference between having a single officer trying to subdue someone and a large number of officers, and how does that change the analysis?
If it's just one officer and one subject, I think the probability for either party to get injured is greater. With two officers and one subject, it's going to diminish. We actually train, if possible, with three, because I believe with three officers and one subject, again, the probability for any of those involved to get injured lessens. With one, like in this encounter, you could have one officer trying to control one arm, another officer another arm, and a third officer trying to control the legs. That's actually how we train. I do believe, to a point, more officers correlates into safety for all the parties.
That's common sense, right? I mean, you have
yes.
a number of officers trying to subdue someone, then it changes the balance of force, if you will.
Correct.
Is an officer required to give an oral warning before discharging a taser?
Yes, if time allows. So there is a little caveat there, but generally speaking, yes, they are.
And I'm just picking up on this because it was part of what you testified to counsel. And your understanding is that a warning was given?
That's correct.
And is that in dispute in this hearing?
Not to my knowledge, no. Okay.
And under what circumstances, again, could someone be relieved of the obligate duty to give a warning?
For safety reasons, if it's simply if no time allows, obviously not in this case, but if somebody pulls a knife and starts running at you, and if you think a taser is going to be effective, you're not going to take the time to, say, drop the knife or I'm going to tase you if they're actively advancing on you, as a hypothetical.
Chief, one of the terms that you've called out in the directive that's before us is the meaning of the phrase active aggression.
Yes.
And I guess just in terms of interpreting that and applying that concept to the facts in this case, how much of that is an objective standard and how much is a subjective standard? What guidance do you have for us in terms of the interpretation? Because to me, there's an objective and a subjective component, but I don't have a clear sense of either.
Okay. In this specific case, Officer B, when he's down by the legs of the complainant and the complainant's kicking hard enough to knock the officer over, to me, I think that's a clear example of active aggression. He's struggling. He's fighting. Later on in the video, when he's trying to do a push-up, and you can see it better on his left arm, that's active aggression of you're not allowing the officers to put you in handcuffs. You're obviously not complying, and you're trying to get up and get away. What would example of not active aggression mean? If you're intoxicated, let's say, and you're stumbling, and you're just pulling away from the officer, but not too hard. I mean, it's a little bit of a sliding scale. And there's some resistance there. I wouldn't say that's active aggression. I mean, to me, I think watching that video the first time I saw it, when the officer gets kicked towards the wall, frankly surprised me. I mean, that's a pretty good kick to do that to that officer.
You talked a little bit about the duty to avoid a higher use of force. Now, in this particular instance, what would have give us an example of a higher use of force beyond the use of a taser?
A couple of uses of force, and that in my mind would be a higher use of force would be strikes or punches to the complainant. higher likelihood of complainant being injured and or the officer, or the use of the aspaton, you know, striking the subject with a metal stick, I think would be a higher use of force and more, again, more likely for the complainant to get injured by that. With a taser, there's no residual. It changes the person's, it can, when appropriate, changes their active aggression stance at times. Instead of, you know, trying to get away, it gives the officers a few seconds to handcuff the subject. I have been tased. It hurts, yes it does, but once the taser charges over, there's no residual impact. I believe that is a lesser amount of force and less likely to injure the complainant versus punches or strikes or hits with an aspaton.
Chief, is that hierarchy of use of force clearly set forth in the rules?
Yes, it is, and in training.
And in training, and it makes clear that that the use of a taser is that there's a higher use of force that follows that. It includes punching and use of baton and other tools.
Yeah, we've moved away from the levels of continuum, but that is correct. I mean, actually, to me, the drive stun mode is even more minor, if you will, than shooting the taser probes. That wasn't affected the first couple times, so then the officer, because each time you use it, you have to assess whether or not it's effective. After two times, it's not being effective. So the officer tries to use the probes because that greater spread has a, if done correctly, has a greater impact on a subject. So the officer, in their minds, working up that scale.
Chief, I have one other question, then I'll come back after my colleagues. But so we are being asked to apply a reasonable person standard. And a reasonable person, when confronted with the facts in this case, I think would ask a basic question, which is, why did it require six different uses of a taser to subdue a person, particularly when there were three officers and one person? And that, on its face, I think, is a question that people would ask in this case. What's your response?
2 points. One, I think it's a very reasonable question. The officer thought they activated the taser three times, though the computer chip in the taser, when you do the taser download, indicates six. So the officer thinks, in his mind, he has to use it three times. Again, in the video, when he's holding on, they're struggling. My assertion is he's hitting that button on that taser he was testing, and it's going off without having contact with the complainant, and the officer simply doesn't know it. That's, in my mind, where you have the discrepancy of the officer thinks it's three, but in reality it's activated six times. But again, it's not six times. In the way I read the reports and view the video, it's not six times on the complainant. To your other point about the reasonable person standard, I believe it was already mentioned, but if not, I mean, the assistant chief of operations, the person who wrote the finding, the internal affairs captain, and the IPR director or their designee at the time all concurred with the original finding, which is the higher level that they have to review this at, where CRC views it at the reasonable person standard. So you made 2 points there.
Yeah, you lost me in that last point there. So you're saying the IPR director believe the higher standard than the reasonable person standard?
Well, at the time, all those folks I listed, they have a different level of review, a different standard, and they all affirmed exonerated with debriefing before it went to CRC.
I'm a little confused trying to follow how many people were involved in this. Obviously, Sergeant A started it, but then Officer B and Witness Officer C arrived, and then there's a Witness Officer D and a Sergeant E. So what would be described as a Witness Officer?
Somebody who just viewed and didn't have any physical interaction with the subject.
But then it says that Witness Officer D positioned herself on the left side, So is there a protocol that you always call in other officers who are just going to be witnesses?
No.
And so if the issue was three people not being able to restrain the complainant, why were there then two witnesses just taking notes rather than helping to secure the person?
So I can explain real quickly. In the context of these cases, the involved members are the members who actually have allegations of misconduct against them, and officers that don't have allegations of misconduct are called witness officers. So in this case, there was no allegation of misconduct against Officer C. Even though she was involved with the incident, she's called a witness because she is a witness to the allegations of misconduct on the part of Officer B and Sergeant A.
Yes, I guess my concern is I'm having trouble following who's what. So if a person is having an altercation like this, it might be difficult to recognize who's been hands-on and who has not. And it seems like the CRC focused a lot on the use of the taser and how much that was used. Was there consideration of the initial putting the subjects against the wall and basically going towards him when it started with a traffic argument?
Yeah, so Sergeant A had allegations against him, but all those allegations were, I believe, exonerated.
And the CRC affirmed that.
All right, I'll ask them when I get back up again. Thank you.
I just want to make sure I'm understanding the sequence of events. So he was followed down the street. The lights went on. He dismounted his bike. The police car pulled up. He pulled the bike onto the curb. And then he was ordered to do something. His hands up. Or turn around. And at that point, the taser's deployed for the first time. Is he standing or not standing?
No, you wouldn't trust that.
Yeah, sure. So
you could walk me through.
So you've got a pretty decent just kind of general description. So once they tell him to turn around, their objective is to kind of use the wall to push him up against the wall and then take him into custody with his hands behind his back. And that is the point where Officer B, who is actually riding in the car with Officer C, when they come up is right when the video starts. They're engaged with him up against the wall. And Officer B says in his report and in his statements that he saw one of the complainant's hands back in a fist, and based on his observations of what he described as kind of violent behavior and aggressive speech, shoulders rolled forward, he took that, and actually in answer to Commissioner Fish's earlier question, those are kind of the objective things that he took in. His subjective belief was that the complainant was about ready to strike Sergeant A, and that's what caused the first application of the taser.
But there was no violent behavior. There was aggressive behavior, right? I mean, he didn't punch anyone or...
With the officers, not at that point, no.
So the first taser...
Activation.
Is he still standing?
Yes.
Okay, and then he falls to the ground?
Yes.
Okay. And then there's a struggle, arms and legs... But there's two more activations, one in the calf and one in the back. And those are the two I'm confused about because he does seem subdued at that point. So I just want to make sure, because the video is, it's hard to tell what's going on in the video. So
it is hard, and I apologize. I probably have like 30 hours in review in this case, and to give you a fairly detailed presentation in 10 minutes is a little bit of a struggle.
Understood,
So, you know, the kicking on the ground, the pushing up off the ground, I mean, he's not compliant and being placed in handcuffs. The actions that he's doing, not obeying commands, not obeying orders, and all the physical movements with that, again, it's my assertion and others as well that that is still active aggression.
Okay.
Chief, I have a couple
Could I just follow up on Chris Daly? It says in the record, though, that people were actually sitting on him at that point while he was face down.
We could watch the video again. I mean, at one point, Officer B tries to get on his legs after he's kicked. So one way to safely do that is you could trap somebody's legs and sit on them to avoid getting kicked. Sergeant A is trying to get his left arm behind his back, and Officer B, she never really got control of